From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Christmas, it's about faith and it's about shopping. And we have interviews on both on today's Fresh Air. First, we talk with Karen Armstrong, author of the new book, A History of God, about the idea of God in Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. Armstrong is a former nun who now thinks of herself as a freelance monotheist. Then we meet one of the stars of the retail world, the man who created the Bloomingdale's legend, Marvin Traub. He spent 41 years with the company, moving from the basement to the position of CEO. And Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Leonard Bernstein's first Broadway musical, On the Town, featuring an all-star cast. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton has ordered his personal lawyer to provide federal investigators with all documents related to his investment in an Arkansas real estate partnership. The White House said the documents will include those removed from the office of Vince Foster, the president's White House lawyer, who committed suicide last July. The partnership, known as the Whitewater Development Corporation, has been linked to a failed savings and loan institution that's under federal investigation. Federal investigators have never made a formal request for the files. The Clintons have said that their investment in the Whitewater Company involved no wrongdoing and ultimately resulted in a $69,000 loss for them. The Clinton administration is trying to persuade Boris Yeltsin to cushion the impact on the Russian people of the conversion to a free market economy. Presidential adviser Strobe Talbot said Russia should consider some kind of social safety net. Barry Schwide has more.
The administration still sees the strong showing by extremists in the December 12th election for a new Russian parliament as a bump in the road. Reformers were elected as well, enough, they feel, to help President Yeltsin extend his reform program. The strong showing opponents of reform made within the Russian military is being interpreted not as military opposition to reform, but dissatisfaction with living conditions. Still, administration officials are stepping up their call for a social safety net, such as Social Security, and they're inclined to agree with the International Monetary Fund's policy of tying aid to Russia to anti-inflation efforts. If there is anxiety over the strong showing of extremists, administration officials are keeping it to themselves. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
The mayor of Bethlehem has threatened to cancel Christmas celebrations unless Israel allows Palestinian flags to fly in front of City Hall. Israel says the mayor is violating an army order. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
This year was supposed to be different. The first Christmas after Israel and the PLO signed an agreement was supposed to see the first public celebrations in Bethlehem since the Palestinian uprising began 6 years ago. But a flap over a Palestinian flag has turned into a test of wills that shows that real peace is still far away. Bethlehem Mayor Elias Frege, a longtime moderate, hung a flag, a symbol of Palestinian hopes for a state, outside the municipality. The Israeli army ordered him to take it down. Frege refused, and last night the flag disappeared, only to be replaced today with four new ones. Israeli officials say they prohibit Palestinian flags on public buildings. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost nearly 5 points today to close at 3,758. Advances led declines by 3-2. This is NPR News. Exiled Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide said today that he'll convene a multi-party conference in Miami next month aimed at restoring his elected government to power. The conference is set for January 15th, the deadline set by the United Nations Security Council for Haiti's military rulers to step down or face tighter economic sanctions. An Aristide spokesman said today that the conference will not include Haiti's current military leaders. A federal court in Cleveland has convicted a mother and daughter of lying about finding a syringe in a can of Diet Pepsi during last summer's Pepsi scare. Kevin Niedermeyer of member station WKSU reports.
After 9 hours of deliberations, a jury convicted Akron area residents Deborah Garner and her daughter Dawn of disseminating false information about a consumer product and lying to federal investigators. During last June's nationwide tampering scare, the Garners videotaped themselves opening a can of Diet Pepsi over their kitchen sink and finding a syringe inside. Attorneys for the women had argued that the syringe could have been put into the can when it was being filled, but the jury wasn't swayed. The Garners both face up to 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine. Sentencing is scheduled for February. Last week, another Northeast Ohio woman pleaded guilty to a charge of falsely reporting finding a needle in a Pepsi can. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Niedermeyer in Cleveland.
Officials at hospitals in Sarajevo say that Serbian gunfire killed at least 6 people and wounded more than 50 today in the Bosnian capital. Today was to have been part of a Christmas truce agreed to by all sides last week and reaffirmed yesterday. Peace talks among the 3 warring factions collapsed today in Brussels after the Muslim-led government rejected an offer of additional territory from the ethnic Serbs and Croats. The government said the territory was not land that had been occupied by Muslims before the war. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As my guest Karen Armstrong writes, religion can express the wonder and mystery of the human experience. Faith helps people find value and meaning in life. For people of the Christian faith, this is the holiest time of year. My guest Karen Armstrong is the author of the new book, A History of God. It's about the idea and experience of God as expressed in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Armstrong describes how monotheism emerged in a pagan world, and she considers the similarities and differences between the 3 monotheistic religions. Armstrong is a former nun who now studies the world's different religions. She lives in England. She describes her new book as being a history of the human idea of God.
Throughout history, Jews, Christians, and Muslims have all been very careful to insist that our idea of God, our experience of God, is radically different from the reality to which it points, which is beyond ideas, beyond words, beyond concepts, and beyond human understanding, and it's absolutely mysterious. And so they say they made the point that all our ideas about the divine, about the sacred, can only be human and man-made. And they are, as it were, symbols of this absolute mystery, which has been experienced throughout human history by all kinds of men and women.
Yeah, you suggest that the Bible should begin, "In the beginning, human beings created God."
Well, that's one way of putting it. They created the idea, their particular idea of God. Other people have expressed this sense of transcendence and mystery in other ways. Buddhists, for example, would talk about nirvana rather than God, and they find our Western notion of a personalized God very limiting indeed. I mean, in fact, some would even say that it was blasphemous because it is simply a projection of human fears, human desires, onto an imaginary being, where they say it's far too limiting. But throughout religious history, people have had a very similar experience of mystery and transcendence, which monotheists, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, have decided to call God.
What are some of the most remarkable differences between paganism and monotheism as expressed through Judaism, Christianity, and Islam? I mean, what were some of the major ways that they broke with the past?
Well, it was a painful break with the past. I mean, if you read the accounts of the prophets of Israel, people like Isaiah, Amos, Ezekiel, Jeremiah, you feel a great sense that they are peeling themselves away from the mythological conception of the Middle East, and developing quite a different kind of spirituality. I mean, it is difficult. They experience this divine force as a terrible shock. Isaiah felt, when he had his vision of God in the temple in Jerusalem, he felt that he was close to death. And Jeremiah felt the divine as a sort of a hideous pain that racked his every limb in agony. What the prophets were insisting on was that history and current political events could yield a revelation of God, that you didn't have to create mythological stories, but God was actually present in the events of this world. And that has continued to characterize the other monotheistic religions. Christianity, of course, goes so far as to say that God actually became human and involved himself that way in human history. And in Islam, the whole idea of God manifesting himself in political events and as a political imperative to create a just and equal society has been equally strong. So that would be one of the main things that they were saying. You don't necessarily create elaborate mythological stories about the creation of the world or elaborate temple liturgies that recreate those ancient myths of the past. Instead, contemplate history. Contemplate the events of this world, and you'll find the divine there.
Now, Karen Armstrong, you are a former nun. You now teach at a college for the study of Judaism and the training of rabbis, and you're an honorary member of the Association of Muslim Social Sciences. So you have some affiliation with all three of the faiths that you discuss the history of in your new book. Do you feel close to all these, to all three religions?
Yes, I do. And I think this is one of the marvelous religious events of our time, that for the first time in human history, we have an opportunity, unprecedented before, of getting intimately to understand the faith systems and the faith of other people. Before, Buddhists, for example, lived in very exotic, distant parts of the world, and it was really impossible for Western people, because of language difficulties, communication difficulties, to see what they were on about. And we got very, very distorted ideas of other people's religions. But now, because communications have opened up, we realise that in our different parts of the world, we've all been doing such radically similar things that we'll never be able to see either our own or other people's religious systems in quite the same way again. It's a revolution in religious thought that some people find very threatening, and they're retreating into rather fundamentalist denominational ghettos, but which others find enormously exciting, and I'm one of them.
Do you worship in each of the religions?
No, I don't. My religious history has been rather problematic. And I think that I get my spirituality from study. Mm-hmm. Now, my Jewish friends tell me that I'm tremendously Jewish in my spirituality because, of course, the notion of immersing yourself in a sacred text or in a religious book and getting, as it were, glimmers of transcendence and mystery from that intensive study is a very Jewish discipline. And similarly, the Benedictine monks have evolved a discipline which they call Lectio Divina, divine study, where they say that you, just like Jews, you throw yourself into the text, open yourself to it, and you will periodically get moments of intense oratio or prayer where your mind is sort of lifted up and you sense a mystery. And I suppose that is at the moment, though things could change, my chief means of worship.
You said religion was very problematic for you when you were young. What was the idea of God that you grew up with?
A rather harsh taskmaster. I definitely saw God as a personality up there who was like a human being or an earthly authority figure, very carefully taking notice of my faults and failings, and who would be angry or displeased if I didn't live up to his hopes for me or his desire for me. And that I found very inhibiting. I also found it difficult. I spent, of course, my years in a convent, a great deal of time in meditation and prayer, trying to get in touch with this God. Nothing seemed to happen. Whereas I never seemed quite to have a religious experience that I wasn't aware that at some level I'd manufactured for myself. Now, I wish I'd known then some of the things that I've discovered since, that certain rabbis or Sufis, the mystics of Islam, would have taken me aside and said to me, look, Karen, you can't... you have, in a sense, to create your own way of knowing God. You have to create your own experience, and that God isn't going to talk to you like a person, because he is not a personality that uses words necessarily. And that, in fact, some of them would go so far as to say that God does not even exist, that it's wrong to use words like existence to describe a reality that's on a completely different plane. And that's why Jews, Christians and Muslims throughout the history of monotheism have preferred to call God nothing rather than something. Now, this was light years away from the God of my childhood, who became rather a sort of a dreaded taskmaster to me. It was, but I think it's an idea that of God that many people in the Western world share. And in Britain, certainly, many people have abandoned it. I mean, we're a very secular country here in Britain, and London is said to be one of the secular capitals of the world, because people know no longer find this God, either this notion of God, either credible or desirable.
If your image of God was as this stern authority figure just waiting to punish you, why did you join a convent? Why did you want to become a nun?
I was aware that this was a limited view of religion, even to an extent even then. I began to read the writings of T.S. Eliot, St. Augustine, some of the 17th century English metaphysical poets, and began to realize that there was a whole range of sort of mystical and spirituality that I wanted to get in touch with. I wanted to share in that, but it wasn't, the religious life wasn't for me. And I think I don't regret my years in the convent in the slightest. I think it was an extremely valuable and privileged time for me. And I left the religious life with tremendous sadness, because I felt that I could only regain my own integrity by returning to the world. But it was a very painful decision, probably the most painful decision I've ever made. But I wanted to find this reality called God, but I couldn't find it in that setting.
Why couldn't you find it in the convent?
I think that very few human beings are able satisfactorily to lead an entirely celibate life, to live an intensely communal life, and to own no possessions, and to be entirely pliable to the will of another. I did meet one or two nuns in my religious congregation who were admirable human beings and who were clearly fulfilled by this way of life. But there were others, and I was one of them, for whom it was not right. It's very, very difficult indeed to live a holy celibate life, for example. And I think, too, that at that time, we're talking about the 1960s, before the reforms of the Second Vatican Council had filtered through to the religious orders. Convents and indeed monasteries were in rather a bad state. They'd got fossilized, a lot of old unhealthy traditions had got sort of pickled, and we were being made to conform to Victorian standards, really. We were being turned into young Victorian young women, there's no particular religious significance attached to the Victorian period. This was just a distraction. But there was also a lot that needed sorting out. And later convents did sort out the essentials from the cultural baggage they'd acquired along the way. And indeed, many, many people did leave the religious life. And I think that during the 1970s, and I think that's a healthy development, because, as I say, this kind of life is very hard, and I think only a few people can live it successfully.
In your book, you write that God figured very little into the life that you led in the convent. How could that be?
Well, we spend a lot of time on what I might call secondary religious enthusiasms. There's a great deal of time was spent on Jesus and thinking about the rule, and a great deal, unfortunately, and this was one part of some things that were wrong with religious life at that time in many congregations, on our own failings and on our own performance. Now, if you're concentrating so much on yourself and your own virtue and your own prayer life and your own observance of the religious rule of your order, you're falling into what Buddhists would call an unskillful state, which simply embeds embeds you in the ego rather than helping you to transcend it. We were all so conscious, at least I certainly was so worried about myself and how I was getting on religiously, that if a religious experience had come along and hit me on the nose, I wouldn't have been capable of responding to it. Because what the great masters of the spiritual life say is that really take your eyes away from yourself, lay yourself aside. You're not that important, and try and get beyond that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Karen Armstrong. She's the author of the new book, A History of God, The 4,000-Year Quest of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Let's take a short break, and then we'll continue our conversation. This is Fresh Air. Back with Karen Armstrong, author of the new book, A History of God, The 4,000-Year Quest of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. What was it like for you when you first started studying Islam and Judaism and, you know, becoming interested in the other monotheistic religions?
I found it amazingly liberating and wonderfully inspiring, and I continue to do so. Also, don't forget Eastern Orthodox Christianity. We often rather chauvinistically forget about Eastern Christianity in the West and assume that Christianity is a Western phenomenon. But of course, Christianity began in the East. All the important theologians in the early church were Greeks speaking and all came from the area that we now know as Turkey. And they have a really quite different notion of God and the divine, which I found in many senses more congenial to me than my own Roman Catholic tradition. And I think that's one of the fascinating and wonderful things about comparative religion. It's not that you want to convert necessarily to another religion, but rather that looking at other religions makes you see your own in a different light. And you see things, I see much more clearly now what my own tradition was trying to do at its best by looking at what Jews, Muslims and Eastern Orthodox Christians were making of the same problems.
Do you still think of yourself as Catholic?
No, I don't. I am no longer a practicing Roman Catholic for all kinds of reasons. I admire the spirituality of the Roman Catholic Church, its sort of spiritual history, its liturgy. I have great problems, however, with the Vatican, with some of its ideas of the idea of the infallibility of the Pope and the obligation to believe certain things, which is a trap into which Western Christianity has fallen. We got into a doctrinal obsession, which is quite alien to the other faiths. Islam and Judaism, for example, are religions of orthopraxy. They have, they insist that you do things in a certain way. But what you believe about God, within reason, is very much your own business. There's no word for theology in Hebrew as such. But theology has been an absolute obsession with us. And Christians and have divided and split up from one another into denominations on abstruse points of doctrine, which seems to me to be in danger of an idolatry, which not in the sense of worshipping a statue, of course, but in the sense of raising a human image of God and the divine to an unacceptably high level by saying that any human idea can adequately express the reality that we call God. In other words, God and religion are not realities that are objective, like science, the same for everybody, but they're deeply, deeply subjective. And I think that sometimes, certainly in the Roman Catholic Church, there's too much stress on believing certain things. We've begun to equate faith with belief, with accepting certain man-made religious opinions.
So when people say to you, what is your religion? What do you say?
I usually say that I'm a freelance monotheist. I draw sustenance from at the time being from all of them, and I think that's probably quite a valid way to be at the end of the 20th century.
So, what will you be doing on Christmas?
Well, on Christmas Day, I shall probably go to church with my mother. And then I shall come back. We shall probably put carols on the radio, and we shall have a very pleasant and happy day.
So the fact that you no longer think of yourself as Roman Catholic doesn't stop you from enjoying Christmas?
There's certainly not. There's no point in flouncing out of a church in an egotistic way. What one does is see what the Christmas story means. It's an extraordinary example of the pathos of the divine when it encounters the world, something that Jews and Muslims have suggested too. The whole theme of incarnation, as I said earlier, is found in nearly all the world religions, even in Judaism and Islam. So that looking at the Christmas story, the Christmas myth, can be an extremely fruitful religious experience. You don't have to belong to be a paid-up member of a church or a card-carrying Catholic to see the religious significance of a festival like Christmas.
Tell me more about what the Christmas story means to you.
I think that at Christmas we see God involving himself in the world in a very particularly daring way. It's, I think it is a myth. It was conceived in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke as what Jews call midrash, as a reflection on the life and message of Christ. And I think it shows God involving himself with the world, and that God and humanity are inseparable, that what we like to think of as the divine is not just a reality out there, but it is within and part of the human race too.
You know, a lot of people now are trying to recreate religions to be more relevant to today, to be less sexist, to add rituals that make sense in the context of life in the 1990s. Are you comfortable with that idea of reshaping religion to suit contemporary values?
Look, there's nothing whatever new about this. What my whole book is trying to say is that this change has always gone on. It's nonsense to think that we can believe in God and Jesus in the same way as the first Christians. Our whole worldview has changed. And throughout the histories of Judaism, Christianity and Islam, each generation has had to confront its particular modernity, confront its own times. The problem will come if people are so stuck in their what they regard as tradition that they won't let the religions adapt, and then they'll die. Religious people are very pragmatic. When a religious idea ceases to work for them, that they let it go. And the religions and religious ideas of God, have constantly been changing.
I want to quote the final part of the last sentence of your new book, A History of God. You wrote, "If we are to create a vibrant new faith for the 21st century, we should perhaps ponder the history of God for some lessons and warnings." What are some of the lessons and warnings you're thinking of?
Well, I'm thinking in particular of the tendency to personalize God so much that we make him simply give a stamp of divine approval to our own prejudices, our own likes and dislikes, and use religion to marginalize other people, to perpetrate injustice on other people, to sometimes even persecute other people and kill them, which is what the monotheistic religions have all done at various times in the past, instead of cultivating the humble, compassionate ethos that says that God is an ultimate mystery, and because God is in each one of us, every single one of us is a mystery, too, that must be honoured and regarded as sacred.
I thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, and a very happy Christmas to you all.
And to you, and a happy New Year, too. Karen Armstrong, she's the author of the new book, A History of God. She spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in London. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, as you finish your last-minute Christmas shopping, we talk with the man who turned his department store into one of the most celebrated places in the retail world. Marvin Traub, the former CEO of Bloomingdale's, has written a new book about the history of the store and new trends in shopping. He's now selling through television home shopping and infomercials. Last night, many PBS stations presented a concert version of Leonard Bernstein's first Broadway show, On the Town. There's a new CD of that production featuring an all-star cast including Frederica von Stade and Tyne Daly. Lloyd Schwartz has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Anne Bozell. Exiled Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide has called for a reconciliation conference in Miami next month to help settle the impasse over his return to power. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
Haiti's ousted President Aristide has invited members of Haiti's various political factions to attend a proposed conference on January 15th in Miami. The meeting would be aimed at addressing the plight of Haitian refugees and the restoration of democracy. Aristide did not include an invitation to Haiti's military rulers, who sent him into exile 2 years ago. The Haitian military has refused to implement the terms of the Governor's Island Agreement they signed in July. The accord calls for the military to step aside and allow Aristide's return to Haiti. Clinton administration officials reacted cautiously to Aristide's proposed conference, saying that without the participation of the military, little would be accomplished. Meanwhile, the United Nations says that it will press for an additional set of economic sanctions against Haiti on January 15th, unless the military agrees to comply with the Governor's Island Agreement. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
President Clinton has asked his personal attorney to give the Justice Department all of the documents relating to his investments in the Whitewater Development Corporation. The department is investigating a savings and loan and a real estate development venture, both of which involve James McDougal, who is a business partner of the Clintons and a political supporter of the president's. The United Nations has begun resolving compensation claims that resulted from Iraq's invasion of Kuwait more than 3 years ago. Hundreds of thousands of people were displaced by the conflict, and damage was in the billions of dollars. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
The United Nations Compensation Commission is looking into three kinds of claims. The first is for individuals who fled from Kuwait or Iraq as a result of the invasion. The second is for damages as a result of death or injury. And the third is for individual losses of property up to a value of $100,000. At present, the Commission is focusing on those cases of death and injury. While individuals will receive up to $2,500, families will receive a maximum of $10,000. The majority of claims are from Kuwait and Jordan. Right now, the Commission only has about $29 million in funds to cover the claims, money made available through contributions and from frozen Iraqi funds. The amount of money available for settlements will increase dramatically once Iraq begins to export oil. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
On Wall Street, stocks closed down today. The Dow Jones Industrials were down nearly 5 points to close at 3757.72. Advances led declines by a margin of nearly 3-2. Trading was heavy, 227 million shares. This is NPR in Washington. The Irish Republican Army has declared a 3-day Christmas ceasefire beginning on Christmas Eve. But the group has not yet responded to calls from British and Irish officials that it permanently end its armed campaign. The Christmas ceasefire in Bosnia has been broken only hours after it was agreed on by the warring parties. The BBC's Bob Simpson reports from Sarajevo.
Any promise that there might have been a quiet Christmas in Sarajevo was dispelled before dawn, when Serb and Muslim artillerymen exchanged salvos. The shelling has gone on all day. At least 500 rounds are estimated to have fallen within the area of the city held by the Bosnian government forces. There has also been sniping. A man was killed near the journalist's hotel, the Holiday Inn, and there's been sporadic heavy machine gun fire with tracer arcing through the darkness close to the city centre. Provisional figures suggest 5 people have been killed and 39 wounded. The United Nations commander, General Francis Briquemont, said he felt all 3 warring factions were intent on maintaining tension as the peace talks in Brussels were continuing, but said he hoped there could be calm with an adjournment there.
The BBC's Bob Simpson reporting. The United Nations economic sanctions are taking a heavy toll on the economy in Yugoslavia. Inflation is running at 33% per day. Today, the government announced it is knocking 9 zeros off its currency, so a $1 billion dinar will now be worth 1 dinar. The nation's economy is growing stronger as 1993 nears its end. Today, the U.S. government reporting rising incomes as well as increased consumer spending and orders for durable goods. The Commerce Department says personal incomes rose 0.6% in November, the 4th straight advance. Consumer spending was up for the 8th month in a row. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I hope your Christmas shopping hasn't left you too exhausted for our next interview. My guest has dedicated his life to making shopping fun, an experience that combined fashions from around the world with theater, food, and surprise. Marvin Traub was the head of Bloomingdale's from 1969 to 1991. He wanted his store to have a personality, to be sophisticated, smart, and chic. He succeeded in turning this department store into a stop for tourists from around the world. Even Queen Elizabeth made the pilgrimage when she was in Manhattan. Traub has written a new book about creating and marketing the Bloomingdale's mystique. It's called Like No Other Store. Bloomingdale's didn't have the same cachet back in 1950 when Traub started working there. It was still the kind of department store that had a bargain basement. In fact, that's where Traub started.
When I joined Bloomingdale's, it was the assistant to the head of the basement, and I had charge of the bargain tables, which we used to have at the subway doors. And the other assistant was a fellow named Mel Jacobs. And in order to build up traffic, because when customers are going through the tables looking for bargains, other customers are attracted, Mel and I used to go into the office, put on our hats and coats, go out and dig through the piles of shirts or pants or sweaters like we were looking for gold. And when you do that, other people come join you looking for the same thing. And then when we had a crowd, the two of us would walk away and let the customers continue to shop at a feverish pitch. Now, Mel, of course, later on went on to become chairman of Saks Fifth Avenue. So I always felt that was pretty good training for the chairman of Saks and the chairman of Bloomingdale's.
Really?
So that was a Bloomingdale's of a totally different world. In 1950, the store had the air conditioning above the third floor was we used to open the windows. The housewares department had wooden floors and just tables piled with pots and pans. And it was known as a place in New York to go to buy the uniforms for your maid.
What a change.
Sure.
Let's talk about some of the innovations that were created at Bloomingdale's. Why don't we start with boutiquing, the idea, for instance, in the women's department, instead of all the skirts and all the pants being on one rack, you've got little boutiques there arranged according to designer.
Right. Well, we cannot claim total credit for being the only store in the country to do boutiques. Obviously, a Bendel had a beginning someplace at about a similar time. But we really kind of pioneered the concept and made it work. And we made it work really starting for a very good reason. We were not on Fifth Avenue. The Fifth Avenue stores were tied to the great names of Europe. And we sought out a way of getting distinction. And there was a whole emerging group of young American designers then, Ralph Lauren, Calvin Klein, Halston. And we began to feature their products in separate shops. And at the same time in Europe, there was a shift away from what was called the couture to the ready-to-wear collections, where there were also some emerging younger European designers who were not part of doing collections, like the Missonis in Ngaro. And as a way of highlighting all of these designers, we began to give each of them their own shops. And that gave them an immediate presence in the store. It made a place where customers could come and find things they did not find in other places.
You got rid of a bunch of departments when you took over Bloomingdale's. You got rid of major appliances, wallpaper, religious articles, televisions. Why'd you get rid of them?
Well, there's some things, if you want to be unique and special, it's very hard. And we really couldn't tell the customer that we had any different television than other people. We had that pet supplies. It was very hard for us to be unique and special. Cameras, similarly. So they just did not fit in major appliances with our image particularly. And we needed the space for things that we could do better with. So we had to be willing to close up those that didn't work.
While you were CEO, Bloomingdale's developed new branches in suburban shopping malls around the country. How'd you like having stores in shopping malls? You were used to a store in Midtown Manhattan at a wonderful location.
Terry, you're asking a very knowledgeable question, because the management before me, the first couple of stores they built in Bergen County and Fresh Meadows, and even in Short Hills, New Jersey, were meant to be freestanding stores. They were uncomfortable with malls. They didn't think they were upscale enough for Bloomingdale's. I sensed that people liked to go to malls, and it was absolutely appropriate for us to be there. So we were very pleased to go to King of Prussia in Philadelphia, or to see our Bergen County store become part of a mall, or Chestnut Hill Mall in Boston, and ultimately become anchor stores ourselves in a mall in Chicago or in the malls in Florida that we were in. So I think the mall is a way of life for American shoppers, and I think Bloomingdale's is absolutely fine in good quality malls, and it worked out that way.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Marvin Traub. For 41 years, he was at Bloomingdale's. He was the CEO for many years, but he started in the basement. And he's written a new book called Like No Other Store, The Bloomingdale's Legend. So we're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Marvin Traub is my guest, former CEO of Bloomingdale's and author of a new book about his life and about the store. You've been out of Bloomingdale's since 91, and now you're in home shopping and infomercials. I mean, you're still merchandising things, but you're using these new TV-oriented ways of doing it. And I have to say, you know, if Bloomingdale's is the height of class in consumerism, then you'd think of home shopping and infomercials as being the height of tackiness. I wonder how you reconcile the two approaches. What do you think?
No, I've started Marvin Traub Associates, and I'm involved with the five consulting clients and a half a dozen businesses that we have an equity in. But one of the first things I did when I left Federated, our parent company, was to go visit QVC. I actually did it with Diane von Furstenberg. And I was incredibly struck with the chord that home shopping strikes with consumers. I sat in a control booth and watched a daytime TV actress named Susan Lucci talk about hair care. And she was on three times over the weekend, and every time someone called in and said, "Susan, I loved your shampoo," the computers went bonkers. And over that weekend of the three appearances, she sold $1.2 million worth of hair care.
Wow.
Now, I know that Bloomingdale's couldn't sell that much in a year. So I try to understand a little bit the appeal of electronic shopping.
Explain it to me a little bit more, because I've never bought anything by television, and I don't think I know anybody who has.
Well, there's a whole generation out there that is bringing up and is using that, Terry, and the appeal is, first, the QVC, which is Westchester, Pennsylvania, is on 168 hours a week. So if you're home, you're alone, and it's 1 o'clock in the morning, you can turn on your television, and there's your friend who is selling something. And I do believe that people relate very much to the personalities of the announcers, who on QVC are fairly soft sell, but come across warm and friendly and invited into people's living rooms. So the women who, and it's largely women who shop that way, feel an attachment to the station. On the other hand, it is much easier to have someone talk about the qualities of a product who is professional, and you can focus in on a close-up of a ring or the way a camera works, and you can explain it actually better. And the service typically is very good. When you call in, they have operators standing by, and they make the whole transaction a friendly one.
Have you bought something on home shopping, you know, on any of the home shopping channels, so you get a sense of what it's like to be the consumer?
Well, the honest answer to that is no, but I helped put together Diane von Furstenberg's program, uh-huh. And I brought down another author named Barbara Taylor Bradford, and a week ago Sunday, I was on QVC discussing Like No Other Store.
Oh, no, you sold your book on it.
Yes, absolutely, and a listener called up from New York to tell me how much she liked Bloomingdale's and how she was looking forward to reading my book. So, I'm sure that helped sell copies.
How many copies did you move?
They sold almost 1,000 in less than 15 minutes.
That's amazing.
And yes, they've done better with other authors, too. Part of the secret is you have to sign every copy.
A little tendonitis, maybe.
Absolutely. No, I'd signed 1,000 copies before I went down.
Wow. So now let's move to infomercials. You're doing infomercials also. What kind of product does well on infomercials?
Well, infomercials is probably the place with the lowest batting average of success. The infomercial industry themselves are not convinced whether it's 1 out of 5 that succeeds, 1 out of 6, or 1 out of 10. And what has succeeded best in the past have been things like juicers. Mr. Juice Man created an incredible number because he could demonstrate and talk about the products.
Uh-huh.
Some cosmetic products have done well where people could talk about the value. We made an infomercial for Thai Foods with Lucy Arnaz, where it did not work, but the foods themselves sold very well in stores all around the country, and perhaps somewhat driven by the early infomercials. We are forming a new company with Iman, the model, creating cosmetics for women of color that will be sold at retail and through infomercials and on electronic marketing, because I absolutely believe in it for the future.
Now, I have to go into your background a little bit. Your parents were both in retail. Your mother became fashion director at Bonwit Teller. Your father was an executive vice president of Lily of France, which is a women's undergarment manufacturer. So I have to know what it was like to have a father in the bra and underwear business, especially when you were kind of coming of age. You know, those are such exotic things to young men.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Terry. People ask me what my father did, and I'd say he was a manufacturer and try to let it go at that. But I did grow up hearing retailing discussed at the dinner table a lot and had a chance to know some of the great retailers of an earlier era. And it struck me as a fascinating business.
What's some of the best advice your parents gave you about retail?
Be a doctor or a lawyer. They never encouraged me to be a retailer. I guess like most parents in the Upper West Side of New York, they thought I should be a professional, but I liked retailing.
Well, one last question. What are you wearing today?
What am I wearing today? I am wearing a polo houndstooth check suit.
This is Ralph Lauren polo.
Ralph Lauren.
A good friend of yours.
Yes, absolutely. And a navy shirt with a red foulard tie, French cuffs. I usually do white collar, which is typically of the way I am dressed. And by coincidence or not, it's all polo, although I do occasionally wear Armani or Gives and Hawks. I just like the feeling of polo clothes, aside from the fact Ralph's one of my clients.
Well, there you go.
But anyway, by the way, I'm dressed as if I'm going on television. I hadn't thought about it that way.
I hope we haven't disappointed you.
Not in the least. It's been really, I can't tell you, Terry, you've asked great questions and brought back lots of memories of the store, and I've enjoyed it very much.
Well, good. I enjoyed it, too. Happy holidays.
Thank you, and happy holiday to you as well.
Marvin Traub is the former CEO of Bloomingdale's and author of the new book, Like No Other Store. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams from National Public Radio in Washington with a word about what's coming up on All Things Considered. Haiti's exiled President Aristide offers to have a reconciliation conference, talking with all sides in his country about the political future there. We'll have letters from listeners. Tonight, they're all about Barney, the dinosaur, on public television. Bob Mondello reviews the film Philadelphia. And I'll report from a trip out to West Virginia, asking questions about a big increase in coal mining there. The coal mining, of course, is good for the local economy, but there's a lot of concern in the state, especially about the big new strip mines. That and other news coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Last night, many PBS stations broadcast an edition of Great Performances featuring an all-star concert version of Leonard Bernstein's first Broadway show, On the Town. Deutsche Grammophon has released a CD of that performance, which was recorded in London. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of both.
Thanks to Jerry Seinfeld and Dave Letterman, New York City is hot again. So it's a good time to have a new recording of On the Town, Massachusetts-born Leonard Bernstein's love song to his adopted city. Bernstein's collaborators were nightclub entertainers Betty Comden and Adolph Green, who wrote roles for themselves in the show and are the narrators of the TV production. Together, they wrote the best New York song after East Side, West Side, maybe even better.
It's a hell of a town.
The idea for On the Town was choreographer Jerome Robbins's. In 1944, the same year as On the Town, he used Bernstein music for a ballet called Fancy Free, about three sailors on a one-day leave in New York. The show, of course, has a lot more plot than the ballet. Two of the sailors fall in love with women they pick up while they're helping their buddy find the girl of his dreams, the one whose picture is on a subway poster because she's that month's Miss Turnstiles. Bernstein caught both the giddy exuberance of New York in the 40s and also the apprehension people were feeling before the final days of World War II. The poignant song, Some Other Time, suggests a disturbing undercurrent of fatalism about what's to come.
Just when the fun is dying, comes the time for parting. Let's just be glad for what we met and lost to come. There's so much more. Embrace, embracing still to be done.
The members of that quartet are Metropolitan Opera star Frederica von Stade, Broadway and TV star Tyne Daly, Kurt Ullman, and David Garrison. Von Stade is the best thing on both the album and the telecast. She has a great voice that she adapts smoothly to the Broadway style, and she proves to be a delightful comedienne as the man-hungry anthropologist who tends to get carried away.
And when I go to see my friends off on a train, golly, how I hate to see them go, for then my love of traveling I can't restrain. The time has come for parting, the train's already starting, I hop a bridge, and in a flash, I'm off to Buffalo!
Met baritone Samuel Ramey, in several smaller roles, also negotiates the transition from opera to Broadway. Tenor Thomas Hampson sings the lead role of Gaby beautifully, but he's stiff as a board, a quality the TV camera underlines. As Hildy, the lady taxi driver, Tyne Daly tries awfully hard, but compared to Nancy Walker, who created the role and sings it on two previous original cast recordings, Daly seems merely frantic.
Oh, I can cook too, on top of the rest. My seafood's the best in the town. And I can cook too, my fish can't be beat. My sugar's the sweetest around. I'm a man's ideal of a perfect meal, right down to the demi-tasse. I'm a common joy for a hungry boy, baby. A brook trout right out of the brook. And what's more, baby, I can cook.
Several songs that were cut before the show first opened are restored here, including a steamy blues number with lyrics by Bernstein himself. It's sung seductively by guest star Cleo Lane. There's also a funny turn by veteran soprano Evelyn Lear as an inebriated singing teacher. The major contribution of this project, though, is that it includes for the first time all the ballet music Bernstein wrote for the show. Michael Tilson Thomas leads the London Symphony Orchestra in a loving and idiomatic performance. He can cook, too.
Lord Schwartz is classical music critic of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the new Deutsche Grammophon recording of On the Town. The PBS Great Performances version of the show debuted last night on many stations. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Naomi Person. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, Richard Parker, and Audrey Voblaitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant, Devin Reif, our intern. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a rock and roll Christmas Eve with Ben Vaughan. We'll hear a Christmas concert with the Ben Vaughan Trio, then Vaughan plays some of his favorite Christmas novelty records. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.